Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.
It's Tuesday, September 25th, 2018, and this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Laura Satsui.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On today's show, we look at how public health agencies have been working to prevent suicides. We also interview a journalist who wrote a book about grappling with his status as an undocumented immigrant. And later, Fresno guitarist Omar Narey is in the studio to talk about his upcoming concert, Echo in Fresno. He'll bring us a preview of the show, which will blend modern and folkloric music and dance.
But first, we turn to Kern County. November's election is the first since the redistricting of county lines there. A lawsuit filed in the U.S. District Court 2 years ago by the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund, or MALDEF, against Kern County and their Board of Supervisors alleged that how district lines were drawn violated the Voting Rights Act. Earlier this year, the court agreed. It ordered the redrawing of district lines and that three Board of Supervisors seats be up for election. Valley Public Radio's Monica Velez reports on how the political scene has been changing since the redistricting in Kern County.
Lydia Gonzalez still lives in the same part of Delano she did a year ago. But even though she's in the same place, she says one big thing is different: the district she lives in and the Kern County supervisor who represents her. And she says it's not just the districts that changed, but how the people in them are responding to the changes.
Now, community members are being more outspoken. They're organizing. They're going out to these Board of Supervisor meetings, budget hearings, anything possible. They're trying to include themselves in these spaces where, you know, usually they're not included.
Gonzalez used to live in District 1. Now she lives in District 4, represented by David Couch. District 4 used to have a majority white population, and now it's a majority Hispanic district. As a Latina voter, Gonzalez says she would feel more comfortable with a person of color representing her, especially since supervisors in Kern County have mainly been white.
It would better represent me and my community and other communities that are Latino-based, just due to the fact that they'll be able to understand some of the things that we go through.
Before the court ordered the redrawing of district lines, there was only one district that had majority Latinos, District 5. According to the documents filed in April through the U.S. District Court, the new map is now equally open to voters of all races and ethnic origins in Kern County, and reasonably allows Latino voters an opportunity to elect candidates of choice in two of the five supervisorial districts. Here's a Cal State Bakersfield political science professor.
Well, if there's been any change, it's been primarily in what is now the 4th district. And what you see with the now incumbent David Couch is that he's actually started taking up some of the issues and some of the poorer outlying communities in rural, at least in the rural districts that are covered by the 4th supervisorial district. And that's really interesting.
That's Dr. Martin Martinez. He says it's interesting Couch now represents a majority Latino district because he's been vocal about not supporting sanctuary state laws since he was on the Bakersfield City Council about a decade ago. While on the Bakersfield City Council, Martinez says Couch proposed making Bakersfield a non-sanctuary city and making English their official language. Both were turned down, but Martinez says more recently Couch
was encouraging our sheriff, Donnie Youngblood, to declare Kern County a non-sanctuary county. And so because of MALDEF, he has made a big shift. I wouldn't say a 180-degree shift, but he's made a big shift in how he's approaching governing.
Martinez says Couch is going to more Latino-themed events and proposing infrastructure projects. Although some may see non-sanctuary policies as anti-immigrant policies, Couch doesn't see it that way. He says handing off undocumented people who were incarcerated to immigration and customs enforcement officials is more preferable than letting them back into the community. He also says
having ICE go into our communities to look for people that are in the country illegally is not a good situation. It's a dangerous situation. It's dangerous for the community. When you hear from other people that somewhere along the line that he's anti-immigrant, it doesn't quite square with the facts.
Couch talked about how a wellness pilot program he just launched is an example of how people are treated without regard to their immigration status. Couch says the program offers free nutrition and exercise classes run by the county health department. He says this program was an effort to do something about high rates of diabetes that affect the Latino community.
And no one was asked their immigration status. And there were many, many people there that were, if not Spanish-speaking only, but Spanish was their primary language. I'm giving you an example of how county government treats people here in Kern County without regard to their immigration status.
Couch says he believes he can be a voice for the Latino community, just like a Hispanic candidate could be a voice for a majority white district. But there's a Latina candidate also running for the District 4 seat. The mayor of Delano, Grace Vallejo, says she's running to represent the communities who haven't been heard. She says, like her family and a lot of the District 4 community, she was also a farm worker.
You have to walk in that person's shoes to understand their feeling of not being heard for many, many years. You know, the voices on the board are not the same as theirs. So when I decided to run, I felt that I was running to represent all of these communities that, while yes, they are predominantly Hispanic, it's to represent everyone that live the kind of lives that I've led.
Vallejo says many residents have expressed to her the frustrations they had before the new district lines were drawn. She says the old map made it difficult for communities similar to Delano to be heard.
And I'm hearing that from many of the residents of the outlying communities that say, you know what, we would ask, hey, help us with our streets, help us. They would say, help us allow our kids to walk to school in the winter without walking in mud.
Jose Gonzalez is the third candidate running in District 4 and is also Latino. He did not respond to messages from Valley Public Radio requesting an interview for this story. As of now, 4 out of 5 supervisors in Kern County are white males. Leticia Perez, representing District 5, is the only woman and Latino on the board. The 3rd and 2nd district seats are also up for elections, but no people of color are running. According to 2017 data from the U.S. Census, about 53% of people in Kern County are Hispanic or Latino. But Martina says there is another aspect to this story, and that's money. The Bakersfield Californian reported that at least $5.5 million was spent by Kern County in legal fees. He says it's interesting
that nobody has really spoken up about how it was really self-preservation on the part of the Board of Supervisors to spend that much money in a county where you see fire and law enforcement officials, and especially the sheriff, you hear the Sheriff Donnie Youngblood screaming that we don't have any money to fill the positions that we need. But the Board of Supervisors had no problem defending a lawsuit that they eventually lost.
Kern County officials did not respond to multiple requests for comment to confirm how much money they spent fighting the lawsuit. For Lydia Gonzalez, who says she is going to vote in the November election, she is seeing how the lawsuit changed things. She says she even had the chance to talk to Couch and has seen him going out into Latino communities and making the effort to listen to their voices. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Monica Velez.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Carrie Klein. September is National Suicide Prevention Month. 2 weeks ago, Fresno County published its Suicide Prevention Strategic Plan. The county has been developing this plan for almost 2 years. During that time, its rate of suicide matched the state's at about 10 deaths for every 100,000 people, but it wants to bring that number down below the state average. And as FM89's Laura Sutsui reports, Fresno isn't the only county looking at how to reduce the risk of suicide.
Noah Whitaker didn't plan on a career in suicide prevention, but it also isn't something he's shied away from either.
Most families don't discuss the topic of suicide. Growing up, that wasn't the case in my household. Suicide was discussed quite a bit. My father's father, Jack, had died by suicide at age 53.
Whitaker's own father also died by suicide at 53, the same age as his grandfather. Today, Whitaker talks about his loss openly. He says he wants to bring to light the day-to-day struggles a lot of people go through.
I lost my father. I lost my grandfather. I don't want my children to lose their father, and I want their children to meet their grandfather. So I do a lot of this work, not just to save the lives of others, but if I become at risk myself someday, to save my own life.
When his dad died, though, Whitaker was still in high school.
Following the death of my father, there were no supports, no resources, there was nothing. Stigma is so prevalently felt that people fear discussion of this topic and they fear supporting people.
Whitaker now works with the Tulare and Kings County's Suicide Prevention Task Force, a job he's held for the last 10 years. Today, he himself is a resource to families who lose someone to suicide as a member of the task force's LOSS team. LOSS stands for Local Outreach to Suicide Survivors. When someone dies by suicide, their family members are at an increased risk of also dying by suicide. Members of the LOSS team reduce that risk by immediately supporting family and friends. Fresno County is in the process of creating their own LOSS team, which is one part of implementing their suicide prevention plan. Whitaker co-wrote that plan. Dewan Utek is Fresno County's Director of Behavioral Health.
What this plan does is it also addresses the concept that somehow, some way, we have to reduce stigma and discrimination against both recognizing mental illness and when someone's struggling with depression or anxiety, making it okay to talk about.
Fresno County's plan also recommends the continuation of local crisis phone centers and training members of the community to be a resource in populations at risk of suicide. While Fresno released their plan earlier this month, Madera County has just begun to look at their own community-based suicide prevention efforts. Dennis Cook is the director of behavioral health there. While he'll look to Tulare and Fresno for ideas, he says it won't help to copy their initiatives because their needs are different.
Like in Madera here, we have 5 times as many suicides as we have homicides. Between 2006 and 2015, we had 36 murders and 193 suicides. Well, if the murder rate went up by fivefold, we would have all kinds of people in the community. And so that's the message we have to give to the community. What could the community do to reduce the rates of suicide?
Efforts to reduce suicide have also come from the state level. Stan Collins is a suicide prevention specialist with Each Mind Matters, a statewide campaign. He says the benefit of counties creating community plans is it takes into account their unique situations rather than focusing broadly on government departments.
Suicide prevention is really a public health issue, and with that, you need to bring in all members of the community. But the most important people that we can be bringing in are really the individuals, the family and friends of individuals who are the ones who are going to recognize warning signs and be there to support that person.
He says the statewide efforts have been successful, but even with public support for mental health awareness, suicide maintains a lot of stigma and unfamiliarity. That's why local campaigns and efforts can effectively spread best practices for talking about suicide. For example, Colin says it's okay to ask someone if they're thinking about suicide.
Everything in the suicide prevention literature says that we need to be talking openly and directly about suicide. And if the answer is no, the person says, no, I'm not thinking about suicide, which is strangely a lot of people's fears. Well, what if I ask them if they're thinking about suicide and they're not thinking about suicide? It's like, that's the best case scenario. And now you've communicated to that person that if they ever do have thoughts of suicide, you're willing to go there. You're willing to have that conversation.
To be clear, Collins knows that can be a daunting task, but starting that conversation is part of breaking the stigma too. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui.
If you are thinking about suicide or are worried someone you know is, you can call the National Suicide Prevention Hotline at 1-800-273-8255 or text 741-741.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. As the 5th largest economy in the world, California is looked to in many ways as a world leader, not just in terms of agricultural production and goals to mitigate climate change, but also in the field of health. We've been a testing ground for new ideas in healthcare policy and delivery. This month, the policy journal Health Affairs devoted an entire issue to examining healthcare successes and failures in California. And Carrie's here with us. You dug in, and you're here to help us translate some of its findings.
Yeah, that's right.
So tell us, first of all, what is Health Affairs, and why did they do an issue specifically on California?
So Health Affairs is a peer-reviewed journal run by a nonprofit health organization called Project Hope, and it's really established itself as a nationwide leader and authority on health policy research. Things like how to effectively manage healthcare delivery and drug pricing, how well the healthcare industry is working. And so as for why California, this particular issue was supported by a number of organizations like the California Healthcare Foundation and Blue Shield of California, and I think these organizations all just came together because it really felt like the right time for it. The future of healthcare in the U.S. has been in dispute since the 2016 election, and really since the Affordable Care Act was signed into law in 2010. And when it comes to these national conversations about expanding Medicaid, about health coverage for all, health coverage for undocumented immigrants, California's lawmakers are some of the loudest voices in the room. And we've tried out a lot of these things here in the state already. Plus, California's huge, and so any experiment or pilot project instituted here inevitably has tons of data behind it that can be used to inform similar projects around the country. So the issue really takes a deep look at a number of recent efforts here and evaluates how well they work in an effort to determine, is California a leader when it comes to healthcare?
Yeah. So you mentioned expanding Medicaid. Let's start with that. So California expanded Medicaid, you mentioned, to cover more demographics than just the federal program. What did you learn from reading about how that rolled out?
Yeah, that's right. We were an early adopter on this so-called Medicaid expansion. And Medicaid, of course, is called Medi-Cal here in California. And so here, you know, it encompasses a lot more low-income people in California than in a lot of other states. It now covers not just low-income women with children, but also some childless adults, some undocumented children, and it expanded the income range a little bit. And this expansion did result in millions more people with insurance. Yes, but the expansion didn't necessarily make healthcare costs significantly more affordable, and it didn't necessarily mean better care. For example, one article found that while more low-income women are now insured, it didn't increase the rate at which they get family planning or basic healthcare. And the Medicaid expansion also allowed more low-income patients with HIV to get insurance. But in order to qualify, they may be subjected to gaps in coverage or less coordinated care. So that's an example of successes and failures simultaneously.
And the journal also addresses health disparities, which we've talked about here at Valley Public Radio. We know life expectancies can vary by as much as 20 years between, you know, neighboring zip codes in the same city. And some of those health measures track with socioeconomic status. But one article in this issue, you've told me, found something surprising about disparities. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Yeah, that's right. It's that that the picture isn't necessarily as bleak, you know, all around as we might have expected it to be. So, you know, to really throw some perspective on this, another research paper in this issue, you know, basically says, in the context of the U.S., we're pretty healthy in California, relatively speaking, and that's in part because we're so diverse. And that challenges some of the typical narratives we've formed about what factors play a role in health. You know, one might expect our health outcomes to be mixed or even kind of lower than they are now because of, you know, there's a lot of poverty and a lot of other real demographic differences between parts of California. But it turns out that, you know, we really have a lower infant mortality rate than the country as a whole. Californians live longer than the country as a whole. And that's despite the fact that we have more poverty and fewer high school grads, for example, than the county as a whole. So, of course, there are pockets of extreme poor outcomes around the state. There are still strong disparities among different groups, even geographically close to each other. But that big picture is that diversity appears to be a health benefit for us here in California, and that it's something that should be studied more and maybe can help us understand health patterns elsewhere in the country.
And let's talk about a few of the specific health outcomes. Last week, you talked to us, or you reported on a statewide effort to bring down maternal mortality in the state. And that was mentioned in this magazine, as well as a few other interventions targeting very specific health outcomes. Can we talk a little bit about those?
Yeah. So a lot of these articles we've been talking about are really big picture. There are some also really specific case studies. And so, as you mentioned, there's this this program called the California Maternal Quality Healthcare Collaborative, or CMQCC, took aim at reducing the number number of women dying in childbirth, and the data suggest it's really been working. From 2006 to 2013, the country's maternal mortality rate rose 65%, mm-hmm. while simultaneously, California's rate fell by 57%. Mm-hmm. And so in 2013, at least, mothers were dying in childbirth at half the rate in California as in the rest of the country. That's tremendous. And there was another initiative that looked in detail at heart attacks. It's called the Southern California, or sorry, it's in Southern California, and it's called Be There San Diego, and it aimed to prevent heart attacks in the county's 3 million residents. It was similar to the CMQCC in that it was this countywide collaborative between health agencies and providers and policymakers, and over a six-year study period, it looks like Be There San Diego did cut back heart attacks and hospitalizations at a much faster rate than the rest of California.
So those all sound like those are successes. But is there an example of a targeted intervention that was brought up that didn't work out?
Yes, there was. And again, there were dozens of articles here, so we can't cover all of them. But another one that I thought was interesting to highlight was that there was one article that addressed vaccines, specifically parents who seek out vaccine exemptions for their kids or who send them to schools that don't require as many vaccinations. So across the U.S. in the last few decades, we have been seeing a rise in vaccine preventable diseases like measles. And in fact, there was a measles scare in Fresno County last month, by the way. It didn't end up being anything to worry about. Researchers wanted to know how a law that related to vaccine exemptions was working. So there was this bill passed in 2012 that required that anyone who wanted an exemption from a vaccine, that they needed physician counseling. So that was meant to be sort of a barrier and discourage people from getting that exemption. Turns out that although fewer parents did seek out this vaccine exemption after the law was passed, the law didn't bring down the rate nearly as much as healthcare professionals had hoped. And so those exemptions are still concentrated in, they're still happening around the state, and they're concentrated in Northern California and in private schools.
So I guess to wrap this up, is California a health policy leader?
Right. Yeah, because that was the whole purpose of this whole issue, is to evaluate this. And of course, it does not give a definitive answer. It's science. It just can give you evidence and then, patterns and trends and data. I think that the answer is yes. And that's because, it's not because everything addressed here in California has worked. Not every one of these programs was a success, but not everything a leader does has to work. I think that what we're learning is that all of these experiments had some elements that succeeded and some that failed. But I think what makes California a leader is that it's trying these experiments at all. Like I said, we were early adopters of this Medicaid expansion during the Affordable Care Act, and healthcare leaders are teaming up in local areas to try to tackle individual healthcare problems. And we're doing a lot of this independently of the federal government, and we're doing it ahead of some other states before we've had other states to show us the way to do these things. And so I think that it's risky, but it's also exciting. And so now we just have to hope that research like this in this issue of health affairs can make it to the right audience, and that providers and companies and policymakers who read it can learn from it and help California implement even more projects that succeed more than they can fail.
Carrie Klein, health reporter here at Valley Public Radio. Thanks for breaking this down for us.
Thank you.
Since President Donald Trump took office, there's been a lot of attention on immigration policies and undocumented people. But these talks have actually been taking place well before Trump's candidacy. Here speaking with us today is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who also happens to be undocumented. He just released his memoir called Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. He starts by telling Valley Public Radio's Monica Velez about what people can expect to read in his memoir.
The book for me is an exploration into the psychology of what it means to be in this country without the right documents and without legal status. You know, whenever we hear about immigration, I think we hear about like the politics and the policy, and we hear about kind of, you know, the aspects of it that make this cable news and the headlines. But I think what we rarely hear about is the toll that this condition takes on people, right? And in the past year and a half since the election of President Trump, and the images are, you know, out there, like nonstop. I mean, every day there's a crisis. To me, what's been lacking is the understanding of what the emotional toll of all of that has been, especially considering that what's happening to immigrants now did not happen overnight. You know, I mean, yeah, Trump is the manifestation of all the mistakes when it comes to policy that we've made, you know, since really the Reagan years, you know, after Reagan signed amnesty in the 80s. You know, haven't had any meaningful reform in this country since that. So, this did not happen overnight. And as I say in the book, I make an argument about the fact that this is not, quote unquote, a broken immigration system, right? Broken makes it seem like, you know, I broke my ankle, I tripped, it was an accident. This doesn't seem like an accident. It's actually, it's intentional. The system is the way that it is because it benefits society. It benefits the government. It benefits people.
Yeah, and kind of going off of what you were saying about, you know, how this kind of explains the emotional toll that being undocumented, like, has on a lot of people. What was it like and how were you feeling when you first found out that you were undocumented after, you know, going to the DMV and trying to get your license? Like, did you realize at that moment how much of an impact that would have on your life after?
No, I had no idea what impact it was going to have. And it was such a jarring, experience. And, you know, back then too, there was no internet. There was no social media. It's not like I can, like, you know, look up hashtag undocumented or hashtag immigration. You know, it's not like I can just figure out, wait a second, like, how many other undocumented Filipinos or undocumented Asian people there are. Back then, all I had is what the media said what it was, right? It was about Mexico. It was about the border. It was about the wall. It was not about people like me. So it was just very confusing. Because the media said one thing, and I was living this whole other thing.
Yeah, and in 2011 is when you wrote that essay about your experience being undocumented in the New York Times Magazine. And, you know, most people don't come out as undocumented so publicly. So, like, what made you decide to do that?
Well, it was either I do that here in the United States or I do it outside of the United States. You know, like one of the lawyers suggested that I leave the country, and if I wanted to come out as undocumented, that I would do it in the Philippines, where I am a citizen of the country. I thought about that for a while, but then I was thinking, well, wait a second, like, doesn't that mean I'm hiding from what this is? You know, the reality is I lied in government forms to get a job. A lot of us have to lie just so we can work. The reality is, you know, my existence in this country could not have happened if I didn't have a network of supporters, mainly teachers and, you know, administrators from the high school that I was at in Mountain View in the Bay Area in California. If I didn't have those people, I don't know how I would have survived. So part of coming out for me was really coming out and letting people in about what this experience is about. But the moment I did that 7 years ago, I didn't really want to do it again. I'm like, I've written the essay. Let me go talk about other people. So I started Define American, which is all about collecting stories of other undocumented people and the people in our lives who help us, right? So it's all about kind of storytelling and how stories of people with different circumstances but share the same condition, how it can really liberate us from what people think the narrative of illegal immigration is. But, you know, I'm going to be honest about this because I think we have to be honest about it. It's been a very lonely, very depressing, very frustrating journey the past 7 years, especially the past year and a half under the Obama era. You know, like, it's been really frustrating and, you know, exhausting listening to people talk about immigration and the problem that we have about immigration as if it happened just like a year and a half ago when Trump was elected president, when the reality is we've been dealing with this for as long as we've been dealing with it. It's just that now people are so pissed at Trump, right, that now they're understanding what immigration is and what's been happening to families.
Yeah, and so for a while, you did have to hide the fact that you were undocumented. And
yeah, for 14 years.
Yeah, and at that time, you were working for newspapers across the country. And, you know, being a reporter and, you know, how you always try to uncover the truth, like, how did you kind of cope with that, those two conflicting kind of things?
Well, that was one of the reasons, too, why I came out, because I couldn't do it anymore. You know, I was in a profession, or I am in a profession, where you have to tell the truth, right? Like, my job is to figure out the truth is as far as I can ascertain, as far as the truth can be ascertained. And yet here I was, you know, living a life and having a career that was made possible by telling lies about who I was and where I came from. So I couldn't do it anymore.
You've also kind of talked about how many undocumented immigrants have different stories but similar experiences, and you kind of describe that as like lying, passing, and hiding. And so can you kind of talk about how that comes up in your book?
You know, when I decided to do the book this way, my editor, Julia Chaffetz, asked me to make a list of all the most painful experiences of my life, which I did not want to do. But I had to do it, so I did it. And then after I looked at while looking at the list, it became very clear that each one of the painful experience had to do with either lying about something, trying to pass as something someone else, or hiding. That was the theme in each, if not all, of those painful stories. So that's why, I keep calling it as like a state of being. So the state of lying, the state of passing, the state of hiding. So those became kind of the dominant theme, and it became kind of the organizing structure of the book. And, you know, as I was writing the book, what became clearer and clearer was that you don't have to be undocumented to relate to that, right? Like, I would argue, someone can make an argument that the American experience is about passing, right? As if America is this experiment that we're all trying to figure out, right? And that no one has a rightful claim to it.
Many people don't understand how hard it is to navigate through immigration policies, processes, laws. And,
I'm going on my book tour right now. I did the Today Show the other day. I've been talking to a lot of journalists because, I have to talk about the book. And the number one question people ask me when I ask them, I'm a journalist, so I like asking questions. Usually I ask the reporters or the producers, what was the thing that surprised you the most after reading this book? The one constant thing that everybody has said so far, I didn't realize that there was no process for you to legalize yourself. I have found that comment staggering because I'm thinking to myself, wait a second. Do people actually think we just enjoy being in this undocumented condition? Like, if we could fix this thing, wouldn't we fix it?
Kind of going back to this one passage in your book, you know, when you talk about covering the 2008 campaign and how you're covering these historical moments, you know, but you say how you feel so removed from them. You know, how did that feel, especially, you know, knowing that so many people depended on your reporting for information that was going to directly affect them?
But that's the thing, though. I never looked at it as people depending on it. I looked at it as it was my only way of existing. Like, the only way that I could feel at the time like I was here was to write these news stories. And the whole time I had to keep telling myself that I wasn't really here. Like, in the passage in the book when I say, I'm here but I'm not really here. Yeah, that's my name in the story. I wrote it. I reported it. Right? But I'm not really here, so therefore it's not really mine. What kind of thinking is that? I mean, and that's why in the book I talk about psychology, because, like, what happens when you don't feel and you don't think that you're seen and recognized and represented by your government? What is that relationship between the government and the citizen? And how does that relationship or lack thereof impact your other relationships? Right? That's why the word citizen is on the cover of the book. Like, what does citizenship constitute? Who gets to belong? Who gets to participate? So these are questions that, by the way, I don't have easy answers to. But as a journalist who happens to be undocumented, as an American who's not considered an American,
I think these are important questions to answer. And asking them is my way of practicing patriotism.
Again, this memoir is called Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen by the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Jose Antonio Vargas. Thank you so much for being with us today, Jose.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Carrie Klein. Last week, we enumerated many ways in which immigrants' lives are being disrupted by changes to federal immigration policy in Washington. Closer to home, however, fraud and deceit here in the San Joaquin Valley are also hindering immigrants, some of whom are legal or are pursuing legal paths to citizenship. The Fresno Bee reported recently a story on how people posing as attorneys or immigration consultants are defrauding locals out of tens of thousands of dollars and legitimate legal help. Here to talk about this reporting is Bee immigration reporter Yesenia Amaro. Yesenia, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So let's begin where your story begins, with a court case. Tell me about this court case involving a woman in San Joaquin County.
Sure. This the Attorney General's Office in 2017 filed a complaint against Jelen Dorothea Brooks after 15 of her clients came forward said that they had been defrauded by Brooks. And the complaint that was filed by the Attorney General's Office and in her plea agreement, also from 2017, it basically specified that her 15 clients had paid her between $3,000 to over $6,000 to basically protect them from deportation, but she did little work or no work at all for those people.
And that's $3,000 to $16,000 per client, correct?
Per client, that's correct.
And so what kind of fraud did Brooks commit here? What was she promising these clients?
Right. So she was basically pretending to be a licensed immigration attorney, although she had lost her license in 2015. And she was pretty much promising them that she would protect them from deportation. The clients trusted her, and she actually then took advantage of their trust. And if they didn't pay her, she even made threats that they would be deported.
And so this woman was posing as an attorney, but in fact had no law degree. How did she trick people into being her client?
That is correct. She was not licensed to practice law. She had, she had been disbarred in 2015. However, she was able to open up a practice here in the Central Valley. And again, experts say that there's a lack of oversight on people such as Brooks, who pretend to be licensed and make promises to people. And that played a role in her being able to take advantage of so many people.
And so this woman was she was posing as an attorney, even though she had been disbarred. But, related to this, and something you touch upon in this article quite a bit, are so-called notarios públicos. So can you explain what is a notario público? And is that just a notary public? Is that the same thing?
Right. So the issue with notary publics is that in countries in Latin America, these professionals have a much higher level of education. Their education is more equal to that of an attorney. And oftentimes, members of the immigrant community think that notary publics here have the same qualifications, but they don't. Notary public here in the U.S. is only able to translate forms and witness signatures, for example. So their level of qualification is much lower than that of a notario público in Latin American countries.
And so this also provides a way for people posing as notarios públicos or who are notarios públicos and notaries public, but to pose as people with more training and more abilities to help immigrants who are very vulnerable in this area.
Right, yeah, or organizations that work with the immigrant community here in the Central Valley say that not all, but some notaries public, do operate beyond their scope. And again, given the lack of oversight on these professionals, they're able to get away with it. They're able to get away with, doing things that only an attorney should be doing.
And so how common is this kind of fraud, against the immigrant community? How common, would you evaluate that is in this part of California?
Mm-hmm. According to the organizations that work here with the immigrant community, it's very rampant. But again, some of the figures are low. And that's because some of these people who are victimized are actually afraid to come forward and file complaints, for example, with the local district attorney's office. So, again, we have, organizations saying that it's very common, but then some of the complaints that are actually filed with district attorney's office are much lower.
And then what are the consequences to these victims who, think that they're filing legitimate paperwork and are on a way to citizenship or whatever else it is that they're looking for legal help with? What happens to them after being involved with someone fraudulent like this?
Right. Oftentimes, organizations say that when these people go to these professionals seeking, legal advice, these professionals end up putting the victims in a much worse situation, and some of them actually even end up being deported or are not eligible for immigration relief benefits that they would otherwise be because, the wrong form was filled out or the wrong information was included in the form, and sometimes, in certain cases, some of the local organizations are able to clean up their cases. But again, in other cases, some of the victims end up being deported as a result.
So some of these victims are doubly victimized, really?
Right. Yeah, they're defrauded of a large amount of money. And at the same time, in certain cases, also end up being removed from the country.
So you mentioned there's some legislation that very narrowly did not actually make it through the state legislature, but could have addressed some of these problems. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. So Assembly Bill 638 went through the Senate just a few weeks ago in late August, but it didn't pass the Senate. But this bill would pretty much have addressed the issue, at least when it comes to immigration consultants. Under the current state law, basically anybody who wants to become an immigration consultant can do so by registering with the Secretary of State's office, placing a $100,000 bond, and passing a background check. And this bill would essentially repeal the statute that allows these professionals to practice in the state. But it failed to pass the Senate, and people will now have to wait until another legislation is introduced.
And so you spoke to a number of different law enforcement agencies and justice agencies here. What are these agencies like the State Bar Association, district attorneys, what are they doing about this kind of crime?
Right. So the district attorney's office does investigate these cases. I know that the Fresno County District Attorney's Office is currently investigating two cases for potential prosecution. Although they were not able to disclose details at this time because the investigation is still ongoing. But the California State Bar said that it's taken recent action on this matter, and it recently created a new unit that basically is in charge of investigating such cases.
Great. Well, we look forward to hearing more about that. Yesenia Amaro is a reporter covering immigration for the Fresno Bee. Thanks so much, Yesenia.
Thank you for having me again.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. This Saturday, the downtown Fresno venue Arte Americas is hosting Hecho en Fresno, Made in Fresno, presented by Danzas de Libertad. The event, celebrating Mexican-American identity, will feature musicians Omar Nare and Patrick Contreras alongside dancer Jasmine La Caris. Here to preview the event and talk about what's new with him and his unique style of music is one of those performers, Omar Nare. Omar, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
So we've had you on before, but to catch people up, you play piano and guitar, and people have called your style Nuevo Mariachi. Mariachi is a very distinct musical style that I think a lot of people will know as soon as they hear it. But can you describe for us what's the Nuevo part in that?
Well, mariachi music traditionally makes you think of Mexico, and Nuevo Mariachi is supposed to make you think of California, being Mexican-American. I'm third generation. My grandfather came over here to give me a better life, and I graduated from the university, and I'm living what I hope he would consider a better life. And I want to make music that honors him, but also that honors my identity of having grown up here in California.
Mm. And so tell us about this event on Friday. Well, can we expect some Nuevo Mariachi as well? What are we looking at here?
Yes, the show is called Hecho en Fresno, and it's going to celebrate Mexican-American identity. I'm going to open up the show with Nuevo Mariachi, and we're going to feature folklorico dancers. And then closing the show is my good friend Patrick Contreras with his project El Violin.
What is El Violin?
El Violin, I describe it as Santana in 2018 on a violin.
Gotcha. So very, almost like influences of rock as well, but
absolutely.
still celebrating that Mexican-American identity.
Yep.
For sure. And obviously, so you're performing with him, and you've performed with him before, but what has it been like to work with him, collaborating with Patrick, with your wife, Jasmine La Caris, and other dancers and such, for this particular performance? What has it been like to pull this together?
Patrick and I have been good friends for a long, long time. We started playing together in a salsa band like 8 years ago, so we've had a lot of experience. I just trust him. With Hecho en Fresno, I know he's going to bring a really high level of musicianship. I know that his part of the show is going to be absolutely entertaining. I'm letting him focus on his side. I'm focusing on my side. And together we're working on the ending. We have to get together and finish that up. But it's been a pleasure. He's one of my best friends. We've done so many things together, and I just trust him.
Definitely. And you've brought your guitar here into the studio with us. Can you share one of the songs that you might be performing?
Absolutely.
All right. What are you going to be playing?
I'm going to play a song for you called No. So, No.
Has visto las estrellas como diamantes en el cielo. Miren a los ojos de mi amor. O has visto una rosa con gotas de rocío en la mañana. Esa es mi amada cuando llora. Cuando llora, tal vez no. Entiende, ella es todo lo que quiero. No. Lo siento, pero yo no soy un hombre elocuente y quiero revelar mi corazón. Pero pero cómo explicaré lo que es la vida con un ángel. Es tan imposible cuando te trato, cuando te trato. Tal vez no entienden. Ella es todo lo que quiero. No entienden. Las palabras no puedo encontrar, pero ella sabe cómo me siento. Está bien que no. Ella es todo lo que quiero. No entienden. Las palabras no puedo encontrar.
Wow, that was wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
And so that's, how many songs will you be playing? And that's one of them, right?
Yeah, that's one of them. I'm going to be playing 35 minutes. So it was roughly about 10 songs. That's an original song. And mostly the show is original. And I have a fantastic musical arranger named Ismael Ramirez. And I just can't wait to show off his work, especially on that song. It has three violins, and it's just so beautiful sounding, and I'm really happy to share off to share this work.
And you sort of touched on it just now, but can you talk a little bit more about what you're looking forward to with this performance, especially being that it's not just you performing the whole event?
I'm really looking forward to people coming and enjoying themselves and having a good time. Arte Americas is a beautiful venue. We're going to be underneath the stars playing acoustic music. I think people are really going to enjoy themselves. I'm also looking forward to singing these songs. We've been working really hard to make them as good as we can. From the music to the lyrics, everything, we're working really hard. And I just can't wait to show people the dance and the music. And I think we're going to all have a great time.
And beyond this performance, what's next for you? What's next with performing?
The next thing that I'm going to do is I'm going to officially go into the studio and record this. It's on the books. It's ready to go. And I'm also going to be filming a live concert. So I'm going to invite my best friends and people that I really respect to come. We're going to set it up and do a live recording at some beautiful venue that I still have to find, you know. Those are the next two things we're going to do.
Have you done a CD or an album before, or would this be that first time?
No, I made an album when I was, believe it or not, I made an album when I was 13 years old. And that album got picked up by a producer named Christian DeWalden, who sent me all the way to Italy. And I worked with a producer. I worked with him. I worked with songwriters. I was there a month and a half. And that got shopped to Sony Records, and we were going to sign with Sony. And then my parents said, hold on, we want you to go to college first, and then you can continue in music. And that's what I did, and that's what I'm doing. So I made an album back then, and I've participated in various recordings. But my own dedicated Omar Nare CD, this would be the second one since I was that young.
Wow, so almost the first one under this style of music and sort of what you've
Absolutely.
Become.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Omar Nare has been here talking with us about his performance this Saturday. It's called Echo in Fresno, Celebrating Mexican-American Identity. The event starts at 6 p.m. at Arte Americas. Tickets are $25. You can find them online. Omar, thank you so much for talking
with us. Thank you, Laura.
And that's Valley Edition for Tuesday, September 25th. As always, you can follow us on Twitter at KVPR. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Valley Public Radio. You can also contact us through our website at kvpr.org.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Valley Edition podcast and download the KVPR mobile app for your smartphone and tablet. Thanks to our editor, Joe Moore, fellow reporter Monica Velez, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver. And I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Laura Satsui. You've been listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.